Turn off your mic. I want to.
Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Russ Avison right here on LA Talk Radio.
Now imagine the vista of the Old West as it opens before you.
That is awesome. Who did this? Is it John Williams?
Silverado. No, that's Bruce Bootin.
Oh, because you know what? It actually has a similar sound to the original Jurassic Park film.
There was almost, yeah.
Yeah, it had something similar. Yeah, like it's, it. Oh, nice.
It's from Silverado. What a great... Silverado has great music.
Yes.
For a 1986 movie.
It was a good movie.
It was a great movie.
Yes.
It was a great movie. A little unreal, but still a great movie. Yeah. Here, let's...
Brian Dennehy. Right, yeah.
There you go. Okay, a little bit more. Yeah, Brian Dennehy. Yeah, he was the sheriff.
Yeah.
He was the bad guy sheriff.
Yeah, he was.
I mean, that was what? Danny Glover, Scott Glenn, Kevin Costner.
And Linda, what's her name? Linda, you know, she played the bartender.
Yeah, the little one. She's on NCIS LA, whatever her name is.
Right.
And Kevin Kline.
Linda Hunt
and Kevin Kline.
Right.
And what a great cast.
Oh, yeah. It was a fun film.
It was a great,
fun
movie.
That was Costner's first movie, wasn't it?
No. That actually was his second movie. His first movie was... Oh, God, where everybody got together for the weekend.
And he was the dead body
at the bottom of the stairs.
Yes, he got cut out of the movie.
Okay, well, this is The Writer's Block. This is LA Talk Radio.
Wait, I got it before. We got time, right?
We got all night.
All right, so Kevin Costner is now doing
Yellowstone.
And he's executive producer also. Yeah. Yes. Have you been watching it?
Yeah.
Yes.
What do you think?
We didn't like the first week.
Yeah.
Because it almost seemed like real serialistic. But it's getting better. Editing is not good. Yeah. But I will tell you that I don't... In fact, my friend Dale Jackson, DB, sent me a message today. And he goes, what do you think about Yellowstone?
My friend Dale?
Yes, friend Dale. I even said hello for you. And I said, well, I like it, but I'm having a real problem with the branding of the...
Oh, yeah.
Of the people on the ranch.
Especially when they got this new guy.
And he goes, you know, we've branded... You know, set cattle on fire with less heat than they had on our branding irons. You know, and I said, well, hot brand, cold brand, doesn't matter. I mean, why are they branding them? That was my question. Mm. So I'm sure I'll hear back from
them. I just don't know why they picked that one guy to brand.
Especially a guy that's just out of jail.
He didn't even want to be a cowboy.
The first one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's sore. He can't hardly ride. Well,
he just got the shit kicked out.
Yeah. I know.
But you know what? There's a reason they've got him, and he's gonna show up and be a good guy.
I think so.
Yeah. He's gonna show up because he doesn't complain about anything.
No. I really like him.
He gets on his horse and it's almost like he's bleeding internally, like Jerry said.
Yeah.
And a guy comes over and he goes, you know, it's the inside that hurts. No,
it's the shame
that hurts worse than the pain.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. He says, and you can control that.
They're really getting down and dirty for a cable show.
Well, it's Paramount channel.
It's MA, so it's mature.
It's more adults than mature.
But they say all the words.
The only thing they don't really have is full frontal nudity. So.
Well, they kind of sort of do.
Well, you know, kind of sort of isn't really.
But it was enough to get me excited.
It's a yeah, but. Yeah.
But it is a good cast. And I got to say, Costner pulls off being a cowboy really well.
Well, he's always been a good cowboy.
Yeah, but I mean, in this one, I the way he moves, everything about him just
seems... He's really intense, isn't he?
He is.
Yeah.
But what's with the gravelly voice? Is that for the
That's
show?
Him.
Yeah.
Does he...
Yeah, his voice is really gravelly now.
Wow.
Well, I always thought he would make a perfect hunter.
I think he's doing it on purpose.
In my books?
Oh, yeah.
Huh?
I think he's doing it on purpose.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
For the part.
Yeah. But you saw Open Range, right?
Mm-mm.
You've never seen Open Range?
No.
Whenever you get a hold of it, watch Open Range. It's Kevin Costner and Robert
Duvall.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Oh, my God. Costner is, talk about intense.
Yeah.
He plays a drover. They're free grazers. They drive their cattle, their little herd around, and they graze them on open range.
Okay.
But they just happen to come into this town where one guy says all the open range is his, and they don't allow free grazers.
Ooh.
So it just progresses to the point where finally you finally learn about Charlie, who is Kevin Costner's character, mm-hmm. is that after the war he couldn't give up killing.
Oh.
And he got really good at it.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, he says, those of us that had the knack, they used us.
Ooh.
And then at one point, he and Robert Duvall are checking their firearms if they go in the town. And Charlie's got this 1873 Colt 7.5-inch barrel. And he goes, you like that light thing, don't you, Charlie? And he goes, yeah, it's fast. and Boss, who's Robert Duvall, says, well, I like my old Remington. He says, it's got heft to it.
It's got heft. He likes
yeah,
that.
Yeah, he likes the heft.
But during this whole movie, yeah. you find out at the end, because he likes to watch the extra credits at the end.
Right.
Costner's had appendicitis.
Appendicitis. He filmed the entire movie with appendicitis.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Riding a horse and everything.
Yeah.
Mm. It, and he even said it kind of made him get the meat of the part, you know?
Yeah.
It was intense for him.
Yeah.
Because he was in pain.
There was some absolutely phenomenal acting in that movie. Who's the guy that died? Michael?
Oh.
Right after that? Oh, God.
Oh, the
guy who owned the stable.
Livery stable, yeah. Yeah.
He died right after this movie was finished.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You'll recognize him when you see him. He's
what year did this come out?
2004.
Okay. It was a theatrical release?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Open Range.
Yeah. Open Range.
Right. It's a really, really, really good movie.
It's a very mm-hmm. good movie.
All right, I'll check it out.
Annette Bening's in it.
Annette Bening, yeah.
Oh, I like her.
Yeah, mm-hmm. she's in it, and so it's a pretty good movie.
Yeah.
So let me get through this. This is, of course, we have a sponsor, for a new sponsor for when his people are on the air, and I actually is one of his people. So, but I'm not billing you for this one, Mickey. This one's on the house.
Mickey Mickelson,
and it's when Creative Edge Publicity was founded in 2016. They immediately showed that they weren't the same as other publicity firms. They work closely with their individual clients' needs and goals and push harder to get them noticed. Creative Edge believes that communication is an important part of the partnership, and that model is how they have built their success. They collaborate and work with local, national, and international media outlets and organizations to meet their clients' goals. Creative Edge is your brand, your future. Mickey Mickelson is a publicist, and thank you, Mickey. You're a great guy, and we just gave you your 30 seconds. Okay.
Mickey's the best.
Out West Shop is your online source for top brands that are a reflection of the equestrian and the Western lifestyle. Shop for unique and distinctive apparel, fashion accessories, home decor, and general merchandise. National brands include Rockmount Ranchwear, Scully Leather Company, and American West Handbags, just to name a few. Shop online at www.outwestshop.com or www.scvoutwest.com. Enter the code WB100 and receive $10 off your order, or call them toll free at 877-340-9378. That's it for right now. So, we were going to have a gentleman on tonight named Peter James. Yet another international writer and a New York Times best-selling author, which I think is the fourth or fifth one in a row we've had here.
And I hope he's sort of maybe got this on in the background right now.
Like, I doubt it, because it's like in the middle of the night
I
for
know,
him.
So wake up!
Wake up! Peter, wake up! You wanker!
I'm awake.
So anyway, he opted to reschedule tonight because we would have been interviewing him at 3 a.m. in his time. He's Greenwich Mean Time, so he wouldn't have been real happy or understanding. I know. What are you going to do? You know. But his book is good.
His book is very good. Absolute proof.
Absolute proof. And it's a story of a college professor that gets a hold of a reporter and tells him that he has absolute proof that God exists. And it just goes downhill from there.
Yeah. I kind of liken it kind of a cross between the Da Vinci Code and The Omen.
Yeah, that's what you were saying yesterday. Yeah,
and
I kind of see that.
The more I feel that way. But it's good. It's pretty fast-paced.
It is. It is very fast-paced.
And he's a good writer.
He's a good writer.
I really like it.
And he's not too wordy.
No, I haven't finished it yet.
But he puts the story out there and lets you make your own decisions.
Yeah.
So
I was going to finish it.
Yes.
But so
then you talked to
Jim,
me.
Jim calls me yesterday and he says, "Hey, listen, you don't have to finish the book." And I said, "What, did the author die?" He says, "No, we've rescheduled. We're gonna actually do an interview with him in November. You gonna live over there, Jim?"
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. No, I'm not.
Shifting
sure.
A little shrapnel around.
I'm not sure.
So anyway, Jim says we're not doing it. So I said, "Well, now what?" And he says, "Well, we're gonna talk about one of my books. So read a book." So so I had today to read one of Jim's books, and. I know you wanted to talk about Jonah Blue.
No. We talk about either one of them.
We made that up, actually.
Yeah, although you do have the excerpt.
Jonah Blue's in the ass, that's right.
Which I didn't read over here. But, yeah, we'll talk about End of Line because it was fun.
End of Line is a good story, I think.
Yeah.
It's a story of a ex-golly. He's an ex-teamster and scout and Texas Ranger, and now he goes from town to town marshaling these small little burgs
right
through Texas and New Mexico.
Yeah, and that's Jeff. Hmm? Is that Stryker, right? Stryker.
Well, Stryker is. Yeah. Stryker met him when he and Bobby were still in Waco, and Caleb was deputy sheriff in Waco.
Yeah, but it goes a different direction than what I thought. I mean, you know, when you read a book or you're watching a film, you kind of, especially movies, because you see, okay, well, they're not going to kill off this guy,
right?
You know, because he's the star, he's got to carry the show,
right?
But in your book, some of the people that I didn't expect to go
went.
Yeah, and I don't want to give anything away, but yeah, it was some unexpected things, sir. I was telling Jim before we went on the air that he is really good at making these bad guys really bad.
Oh, yeah.
Really bad, to where I started thinking, I don't know if I want to stay associated with you because I think there's something wrong with you.
Smart choice.
But seriously, the book was fun. You bring up to speed real quickly what's going on. I mean, I didn't feel like I had to, okay, pay attention because, all right, what's the backstory? It all came right in the beginning,
right.
And I felt like really comfortable moving right into it. And when it gets to one of the, well, I'm just going to say there's a gunfight. And
there's several gunfights.
Well, yeah, but there's a big gunfight.
At the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it really wasn't
not
the
really
end.
The end.
That's right. And that's what got me, because I looked and I said, wait, I've got like 40 more pages to go.
Uh-huh.
And I knew this gunfight was going to happen.
Right.
I knew it was bound.
Everybody knew it was going
to
happen.
Right. But as I'm reading it and I looked, there's like 40 some more pages to go. And I thought, well, now what? But then it became clear and it got real good.
It's almost like the story started again.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was good.
Yeah.
It was very nice. So how long did it take you to write this book?
End of Line, I think 9 months.
Yeah?
9 months, yeah.
All right. And how did you come up with this story?
I don't know. You know, sometimes I come up with a story and then I come up with the title.
Mm-hmm.
This time I think I came up with the title first. Mm-hmm. But initially it was called End of the Line.
Mm-hmm. Was it originally the name of the town?
No, it wasn't.
Yeah, that
was the end of it. Was Caleb's end of the line. But then I realized after doing a little research, there actually was a little town that no longer exists in New Mexico that was called End of Line.
Oh, okay.
So I figured, okay, I'll take out of the
right
end of line.
Yeah.
So now it's got a double connotation. It's where everybody went. That was their end of line.
Right.
Once they were there, that was pretty much where they were going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And for Caleb, it was the last place he was going to go.
Right. You know, interesting too. I mean, you know, a lot of it. You know, there's a few little sayings here that are kind of cliche things you've heard.
Sure.
And, you know, which it's in every book. But then you have some really interesting things that just pop up, and I go, really, Jim? How did you come up with that? One of them, and I don't know exactly where it is right now, but they were talking about there was at one point when Stryker was thinking back on his wife. He had had a wife for a couple years, and then
well, it was actually it was his girlfriend.
Oh, well, I thought his wife.
No.
But she, Juliet?
Juliet was his girlfriend.
And they were together 2 years, and then she died.
Well, they were together. He knew her for 2 years.
Yes.
And she was taken from him.
Yes.
And, or if you read The Return, which is the first story is the deacon and the second story is the preacher, during the story of the deacon, which was called The Dark Angel, the Dark Angel takes her. And
okay, but that's not in this
but anyway,
book.
No. That's so in a prior book.
Right. So in this book,
he's thinking back to Juliet and all the people that he's lost in his life.
Right. And then he thinks back because he's feeling kind of depressed.
Right.
And then he thinks back to the hunter talking to him. And the hunter said, and I like this, he says, when you're through, you're through.
Yeah.
And someone else had told me one time, he says, you ever heard someone will say, gee, that kid, you know, 22 years old, he was crossing the street, got hit by a bus, and he's dead, and his life was cut short. But, you know, when somebody dies at 97, you say they had a good long life, you know. But really, nobody's cut short. It's you get what you get.
Right.
And that 22-year-old person who dies, that's what their life was 22 years.
Right.
And that's kind of the same idea here. When you're through, you're through.
When
and,
you're done, you're
and,
done, yeah.
Yeah, and there's nothing that anybody else can do about it. That's what it was set out to be. And I think the hunter had told him this to kind of put his mind at ease of how life is going to come at him. Because I almost got a feeling that the hunter is kind of like his mentor.
Mm-hmm. Well, he is.
Yeah.
He is. The hunter is not only, and he thinks of Stryker as his son. Because he lost his own son to a snake bite when he was 10 years old. So when he met Jeff, and he just loved Jeff, and he took Jeff on as a protege and trained him and taught him. And now Stryker's much like his own son. That's why if you read when they get the telegram that Stryker needs help and Bucks is... Are we talking about the same Jeff Stryker here? He never needs help.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, because his reputation.
His reputation.
He always handles it. Always.
He does. And, you know, the kid is like real smart. He's savvy. And he's very good with a pistol. But, he gets on over his head, too, just like everybody, occasionally. But that's when Mingo says, Buck tells Mingo, look, he says, you don't get it. You know, the hunter doesn't want to lose Henry again.
Oh, because they had a deadline. That was right. The hunter, they were doing, I don't know what it
was. Well, they were getting horses ready for the army.
Right, and they had a deadline for it. And the hunter says, I need you to get these men and go help him.
Yes.
And they said, well, what about the deadline? And then that's when he says, you don't get it.
No, you don't. Yeah, he says, this is not a request.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and good. even though his name is Tag Richmond, the hunter, even though he owns the ranch, he doesn't run the ranch. But when he says something, I mean, he has enough power there that...
When he says jump, you say
when
how
he
high.
Says jump, they say how high, and do you want me to take my boots with me?
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, but the respect for the man is, like, complete. It's absolutely total.
Yeah. Tell me about, with all the guns in this, and there's a lot of different guns, you know, and they're all pulling out their different rifles.
Right.
And they're, okay. They don't talk about bullets. They talk about the balls. Is that how they referred to it?
Yeah, the bullets, because primarily when they loaded cartridges, you know, so I don't say bullets, it's cartridge.
Okay.
When they loaded cartridges with black powder, they virtually used to use, when they first started, they would use a ball.
Okay.
And that would press the ball into the cartridge, and that's what fired was the ball.
Did the cartridge look like today's kind of cartridge?
No, a lot of them were copper. A lot of them, they just started using brass the end of the 1870s.
Were they shaped similar?
Oh, yeah. It was, yeah.
Okay, so they would take the cartridge, you put the powder in it, and then they would press the ball in on top of the
powder. And a wad, and then a ball, and of course the primer is already in there, and so that was their self-contained bullet, yeah.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
But did they still have, like they had six shooters and...
Oh, yeah. They had six shooters, rifles, Winchesters. They used Springfields and...
Okay. So, I'm a novice when it comes to all this. So, today's bullets are shaped a certain way.
They're conical.
Okay. And when a bullet comes out of a barrel, it spins.
It spins.
And it gets the rifling of the barrel. That's how they can identify it. But because of the way they come out, the way they're shaped, they're very accurate.
Right.
Okay. How could a ball be so accurate?
Well,
because these guys were good.
They were. But by the time this story takes place, which is in 1883, I think, 83 or 84, they started loading conical lead bullets into the shells. Mm-hmm. So that they called them pistol balls or rifle balls, but right. They virtually were a bullet.
Oh, okay. When did they stop doing the round ones?
Oh, probably in the early 70s, when the first cartridge revolvers came out.
Gotcha.
So probably by 1875, 1876, they had gotten rid of the pistol ball itself and started with the conical lead-shaped bullet.
Okay. Was the accuracy better with the conical?
The accuracy was only because of the bullet and the rifling. It wasn't because of the black powder.
Okay.
Black powder is notorious for each charge, even though it's the same, mm-hmm. burns differently.
Every shot would be
every
different.
Shot was mostly a little off here or there.
Right.
So, but Stryker, now see, Stryker carries a 5.5-inch Colt revolver, mm-hmm. 44-40, and he carries a 1876 Winchester,
right.
which is a 45-60 that bullet's that big.
Whoa.
It's a big, big shell, a lot of power to it.
If it hits you, you know it.
So when that's why at the end of the book, when the other fight takes place, mm-hmm. You can imagine that 45 caliber slug hitting you on a galloping horse, and where are you going to go?
Yeah.
You're coming off the ass into that horse.
Mm-hmm. Which happened to quite a few of those.
Yeah, guys. Yeah. And then, but what normally they don't write about or you don't see, well, sometimes you see it in the movies because they've kind of, you know, upped the accuracy a little bit. But what you normally don't see is when those guys were unhorsed, they usually got run over.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to mention that because the first guy that he shoots goes off and they said, and then he got trampled.
He couldn't get out of the way.
Yeah, he was done.
Yeah.
And so a lot of guys that maybe got wounded going
got
off
trampled.
Horse got trampled to death.
Especially if there was a group of guys coming at you.
And there were a bunch.
If one gets hit, they're going down and there's nothing. Those horses will not stop.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they try to avoid you, horses don't like to run on you. But right. if they can't avoid you, they'll go right over you. They'll go right over the top of you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's some things in there that a lot of people aren't aware of.
You know, that actually stuck out of my mind. I was going to ask you about that. Also, the fact that, and this I told you earlier that this made me feel really badly, is that this one guy who's in a hurry to get to his ranch,
mm-hmm.
and he's got a long way to go.
Mm-hmm.
And he rides his horse, and he notices his horse is starting to stumble a little bit, and he keeps pushing, and he gets to his ranch,
mm-hmm.
and the horse drops dead.
Mm-hmm.
So these horses, they will just push themselves?
They will go until their heart virtually bursts.
That's the same with racehorses. They'll do the
well,
same
you heard
thing.
That racehorse had a heart attack down at Del Mar mm-hmm. the other day.
Yeah.
But
see, most horses can't gallop for more than a mile or so.
Mm-hmm.
So normally, back in the times of these guys in the 1880s,
mm-hmm.
I just did that for effect because I knew that this guy, because this ranch was like 10 miles out of town. There was no way he was going to gallop that horse 10 miles. So what he probably did was trot it, lope, and gallop, trot, lope, and gallop to get some distance out of the horse.
Right.
But my guess is he probably galloped the horse the last 2 or 3 miles and
just died.
Horse just croaked right there.
But the horse won't stop?
No, they won't. Well, they will if they'll stumble.
But I mean, if they feel that they're getting to the point where they're gonna mm-hmm. done, they don't stop. I mean, humans
well,
will stop.
They will stop.
Yeah,
they'll stop and refuse to move. Now the Apaches, when the horse fell down,
right,
they would build a fire under him and get him to get up again, and then they'd ride him another 4 or 5 miles until they dropped dead.
Really?
Yeah, and then they're like portable food.
Yeah. Well, remember what was it? True Grit.
Yeah.
When the girl got bit by the snake.
Yeah, he rode the horse to death.
Yeah. That was awful.
Yeah. I felt bad for that horse, too.
Yeah. I mean, I have a horse at home.
Little Blackie.
Is that what it was?
Yeah, it was the first True Grit with John Wayne.
Okay. Well, I have a horse at home.
Yeah.
And when we got the horse, it was from a kill auction.
Oh.
Karen bought it from a kill auction. Well, but she rescued it out of the, you know, it was going to the glue factory.
Yeah.
And, we've had him for 5 years.
Yeah.
6 years, and his name is Lamar, after Lamar Valley in Yellowstone.
Sure.
And anyway, Lamar had a friend, Madison, and Madison died about 2 years ago. So Lamar was, like, really grief-stricken.
Mm-hmm.
So my goat, Henry, he's a Angora goat, and so we put Henry in there. Well, they were just like best buddies.
Yeah.
Henry got sick about a week ago, and I had to take him to the vet. Mm. Well, I take Henry out of there, and Lamar is going crazy, running around and whinnying and just really upset.
Mm-hmm.
So then it brought Henry back, and Henry wasn't going to make it. He was there for about two more days. So mm-hmm. Lamar was like standing over him and sniffing him. And you talk about how horses don't like to step on something. I was scared to death he was going to step on Henry. But no, he moves right around him. And then when we had to put Henry down, again, Lamar was just beside himself.
They know.
Oh, it's just amazing. But then I've seen, like at the racetracks, they'll put a goat out yeah. there and so that it keeps them company.
Keeps them company.
Yeah.
Yeah. And horses are pretty amazing.
I used to have an Appaloosa horse named String of Roses. We used to call him the Rose Man. Great horse. Just the sweetest, kindest, gentlest, big horse. Big foundation quarter horse. Big.
Yeah.
And I knew he was sick and he was going blind.
Mm.
And
how old was he? Do you know?
He was 19.
Okay.
And he was because he had white eyes, so he got night blindness. Actually, what he got was
uveitis.
Uveitis. Yeah. With the uvea, which the lining of the eye gets infected.
Uh huh.
It happens in horses with light eyes.
Okay.
And it got worse and worse and worse. No matter what it did, I mean, I must have paid, $15,000 in vet bills, to help this horse. And,
sure.
And finally, I got another horse because he just was too dangerous to ride at that point. He just,
sure.
I mean, he's blind and...
Yeah.
And so I had Bandit, was in a corral right next to him, and they bonded, these two guys did.
Right.
So in... came the day when I went in to feed Rose and he was in his stall. He used to stand in the stall with his face in the corner, pressing his head into the corner to keep the pain down in his eyes.
Oh.
And he heard something in his corral and he came charging out and ran right into me.
Oh.
He couldn't see me.
Right.
In time for him to stop. So he finally stopped and he was standing there trembling. And I went over and talked to him and stuff. And then I called the vet that day and I says, you know what, it's time.
Oh, God, you're going to make me cry.
So the Saturday came, and then he gave him a shot to calm him down. And
right.
For 40 minutes, 45 minutes, I just stood there and talked to him and mm-hmm. just, told him everything. He's going to feel much better.
Mm-hmm.
And took him down. And anyway, I burst out crying. And I was in misery. So I went up to take the dividing bars out of the corral so Bandit could have the entire corral.
Sure.
And I was bolting it to the other side. Now this is, he comes over and I feel something behind me and I'm using my ratchet to tighten these clamps, those pole clamps.
Right, right.
And I feel this horse puts his head on my shoulder.
Hmm.
And all I feel is this like sigh coming out of this horse. So I pet him and I say, it's okay, Bandit. And so next thing I know is puts his head on my back and shoves me into the pipe corral. It's like, okay, pal, get over it. I'm here.
Wow.
Well, don't you remember the day we were at Happy Camp and we were riding with two or three of the other Shadow Riders and Mariah and Dolly? And I were down there and I was on Dolly.
Yeah.
And we weren't together. We were probably about 20 feet away apart, he and I,
mm-hmm.
on our horses, and somebody rode in the line of sight between Dolly and his horse, and my horse went ballistic.
Really?
Yep. Yes, and I held on my 8 seconds.
Yep.
Bucking and rearing. Yeah.
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 Yeah. Mariah was Dolly was the quarter horse that we got. I traded a trailer for her.
Mm-hmm.
Never could get that horse to calm down. But Mariah was when I got her, she was a 9-year-old Arabian mare, Swedish-Polish mare, 14-2, narrow horse. But she was green broke only. You could put a saddle on her and get on her, but she knew nothing,
mm-hmm.
virtually knew nothing.
Right.
So me and Mariah started with a cavalry manual, 1862 cavalry manual. We went from A to Z.
Right.
And when I was done with that horse, I swear to you, as God is my witness, I could drop those reins and tell her to stand there, and I could walk 2 miles on that horse and still be standing there.
Really? And that's really unusual, right?
No, not so much. I mean, it just takes so much. It takes so little time to train a horse to do things.
Yeah.
It's just you got to be consistent.
Gee, it's just like dogs.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty much. But I got so mad at her at Happy Camp one day, I threw the reins over her neck and I said, I'm done with you. And I started walking back to the trailer.
She
I turn around, she's right behind me, her head doing this. Anyway, so end of line, good book. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I really did, a lot. I have to tell you, I did not read the part where it said about the author.
Oh, well, you don't have to. You know the author. But, you know, there's a family in there, the Kennedy family. And I really liked the Kennedys. And I purposely didn't say their race because I knew that eventually the reader would pick up what they were.
Well, you did with the husband.
With the husband, yeah. But then Miss Sally and then the kids. And when Lewis takes Stryker up to the porch, and she says, "This is what you bring me?" And he says, "Now, hush, Miss Sally. He's the same as us." And she goes in and gets the sweet tea and the biscuits, and she comes back out. She goes, "Lewis Kennedy, are you blind? This boy's as white as a sheet."
That's right. That was funny.
Yep.
But I in reading, and it's interesting, you go back to that part, and I remember that exactly. But I was thinking, white as a sheet, I was just thinking like he's not out in the sun.
Right.
That's what I was thinking. Oh. And I didn't make the connection. I knew
white as the sheet under them clothes.
Yeah. Yeah. But I imagined, I mean, I knew that the husband, that he was black.
Right.
But I didn't, for some reason in my mind, I saw the wife, Miss Sally, as being white.
No, she wasn't. Yeah. She was black.
Yeah, but see, that's all the imagination that you use when you're reading a book.
Well, they were slaves that came from the South and had gotten a homestead in New Mexico and had built the homestead up. And the Morgans had been trying for years to get rid of them because they wanted that parcel of land.
And it was funny how every single time somebody write up, he's out there, you know, who are you? What are you doing here?
State your business.
Yeah, yeah. And then it took him a minute or two to recognize a few people. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Jim.
Shake hands with them. And
Jim Lent. Bountiful Jim.
Bountiful Jim. My favorite.
Anyway, I enjoyed the
book. Let me give...
it's recommended from me.
I have a thingy here that you may want to hear.
Okay.
You actually were going to write me some more of these, and you never have.
Yeah.
What are you going to do? I mean, who are you going to call? Okay. You're leaving on vacation. Tickets have been purchased. Hotel reservations are confirmed. Your mail delivery has been suspended. But, what about the dog? Well, all dogs rule day camp and sleepovers. It's the place your dog wants to be when they can't be with you. All Dogs Rule provides your best four-legged friend a place to run and play outside amongst orange trees and grass in a country-like setting. Your dog gets to be, your dog gets to be a dog. All Dogs Rule offer additional services including individualized playtime, personal walks, swimming sessions in a creek, and training. So visit All Dogs Rule on the web at alldogsrule.com or give them a call at 805-524-1100. When your pup returns home with that smile on his face, it'll leave you wondering whose vacation was better, yours or the dog's. Well, we know, the dog. The dog. So All Dogs Rule. Call them, 524-1100, or visit it at alldogsrule.com. You will not be sorry you did. And it is now 7:32. We're back in the studio with Russ Avison and myself, Jim Christina, and Jerry, the bookie, just walked out. I'm sure she's going to I think we ought to applaud when she walks back
off.
No, he didn't piss her off. Anyway, we're talking about one of my books, End of Line.
Yeah. What year was this one, by the way?
2010, I think.
2010. And I have a nice little inscription that you wrote to me.
I did.
Yeah, but the last two books you gave me, nothing in them.
Well, it's because you don't read them.
I read it.
That one.
Oh,
only because you had to.
Well, no. Actually, you know what I was thinking about? You and Richard did the book together.
We did that one.
And I was almost going to go through that one instead.
You could.
Yeah. But it still brings up a question that I had even before was going to attack that book is, how is it when you have a partner and you're going to write a book together? How does that process work?
Well, for us, it was a little different. Richard had the story banging around for a while, and we had a couple lunches before we nailed down everything, and he finally handed me this synopsis of what the chapters ought to look like, or quasi what the chapters ought to look like, and the two characters. And he goes, okay, so I'll send you the first couple chapters, and then you write the next couple chapters, and then we'll go back and forth like that.
Interesting.
So he sent me the first couple chapters, and I got kind of an idea of what his character that he was writing about, which was David Crockett Hall. Mm-hmm. And my character was J.B. Armstrong.
Okay.
Who was an actual Texas Ranger.
Mm-hmm.
And as we went, I envisioned my character as J.B. Armstrong to be kind of a smartass. He's from Texas, you know. He's got...
He was modeled after you?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, and look who we have right here. You're on the air, Bobby Jean.
Hey, hello.
Hello, hello.
Hi, Bobby.
Turn off the show.
Hello.
How are you?
Stop your chortling. Get to it.
You think she would
turn down your computer. We can you're listening to it too.
I don't know why I'm still walk away from the computer.
Okay.
I'm having trouble. Here we go. I'll move away from the kitchen. I'm having trouble with my microphone tonight. What a wonderful time you're all having together there.
We are. We're having a good time.
Yeah, it's been great listening to you all talking about end of line. And you know what? One of my favorites, Jim, is Bugles in the Sun.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
Can you just tell us a little bit about that book, because it's so different, kind of different from all your other books?
Yeah, Bugles in the Sun actually is it's a journal story told by the only character in it that is not real. Everyone in that book was an actual person. Except for the writer of the journal. His name is John Connolly, and he's a corporal in I Company, and he keeps a journal the whole march from Fort Lincoln to the Crow's Nest at the Valley of the Little Bighorn. And the book ends, it starts on May 17th, 1876, and goes to noon on June 25th, 1876. But it's everything starts with a journal entry. Each chapter starts with a journal entry, and then I go back and tell the entire story of the day after the journal entry. So it's kind of unique in that you get the perspective of the troopers other than Custer and the officers.
And everyone in the book is a real
an actual person, yes.
Except the one that's journaling. Wow.
But I did put him in List of Dead on I Company.
Yes, you did.
I did put him in there.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's really what makes us all, you know, think that. Well, and he's also listed in the List of Dead. He has to be, you know, the real guy.
Yeah, Corporal John J. Connolly.
Hey, Bobby Jean, I got a question
for
you.
And I really like that how you titled the book. Where did you, what inspired you to name it that?
Well, when after the battle on the 28th of June, I think it's the 28th, the 25th, on the 27th of June, as General Terry was coming into the valley, the troopers from the Reno Hill were starting to come down and walk the, and they were making their way over to the battlefield. And Lieutenant Charles Varnum, who was the chief of scouts for the 2nd and 7th Cavalry, was walking the field, and he noticed as he was going, and they spotted finally Last Stand Hill, and he noticed a bunch of shiny objects. So as he walked up to them, he noticed they were bugles. And they were just laying there, glistening in the sun, because one of Custer's things with the 7th Cavalry is that gear was double-checked every single day, repaired every single day if needed. All bugles were polished to a high gloss, high shine. I mean, everything as far as the horses went or the equipment for the troopers was taken care of every single day. Now, bathing? No, not so much. They didn't have to boot black their boots, and a lot of the troopers wore shoes.
Regular shoes.
Yeah, well, brogans, Army-issued brogans.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them wore civilian pants. A lot of them wore civilian shirts. You got to remember, it's 100-and-some degrees out there.
You know? Oh, yeah.
And so they were
wearing
every cotton. What they got rid of the wool and went to cotton as much as they could.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Well, I know that one and Contraband Cowboys, I think, and of course Dark Angel are probably the three that stand out for me, because they're more or less standalone, and they're very different from, in my mind anyway, they're very different from the other books that you've written.
I think so. I think you're right. Well, Contraband Cowboys, of course, is about two black brothers.
My favorite book, by the way.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Is it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a good book.
Yeah, it is, because back in the day, the black cowboy was thought of much better in the West than it was in the East and South. So they came out here and got jobs readily because they needed them, and they were hard workers.
Well, you have to remember, a lot of these guys came from slavery.
Yeah.
And they knew horses. They knew how to ride horses. They knew how to train horses. They knew a little bit about cattle. They knew a little bit about a lot of things. And so they would go onto these ranches and go right to work.
Yeah. They trusted you.
There was no training.
Yeah.
And they were...
Gary, you've been Jim's editor, I think, probably kind of from the beginning.
Almost,
right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How have you seen a development of his writing over the years? I don't know if that's the right way to ask that question, but have you seen a change in his writing style at all over the years?
A little. Because I know his thought process and what he's going to say, it's not hard for me to edit his books, but the last one, this End of Line, and a couple others are real intense when he has to kill somebody off. And with each book, I think it gets a little deeper or more intense. Yeah. So I've seen a little, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, now, see, I go for effect. It's not just gratuitous violence. There's a reason that people get killed off now.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's Jesse Morgan, who incidentally, it was a perfect ending for Jesse Morgan.
Yes, it was.
I mean, it couldn't have been any better.
And you know what? What made me not expect that?
What?
Was the fact that all the way through it, a Stryker was saying that the hunter would not allow it to happen that
right.
way.
Right.
And so that's what made it even better.
Well, he didn't have a say.
No, he didn't. No.
Nobody had a say.
Except Otis.
Otis had a say.
Yes.
But it surprised me when I finished that book and I wrote the end of that book, it surprised me that Stryker got into the hunter's face.
Yeah, he did. He challenged him.
Said, leave it be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He said, sometimes you have to turn away.
Right. Yes, exactly. Sometimes you have to turn away. So I just
Jim,
thought,
have you ever entertained any thoughts of continuing to write historical fiction but choosing a different time period?
Yes.
You know, like Vikings or, you know.
No, not Vikings. No,
you should
not
see his
Vikings.
Face
some
on
other
that
kind
one.
Of warlord, you know.
I did my one Vietnam story at the back of Jonah Blue, and that pretty much is going to be it for that. I'll do another. I mean, I changed it up on Jonah Blue. I started that one in 1830.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that took a lot of research because I didn't know that much about mountain men. I didn't know what they did or, you know, I didn't know. Well, I knew they trapped, but I didn't know. I didn't know what the basic everyday things of living that they did to survive.
Mm-hmm.
A good example is. Mosquito repellent. Now, if you've ever spent, well, you've been in the Rocky Mountains. You know what the spring and summer in the Rocky Mountains can be like.
Oh, yeah.
Well, mosquitoes are like, they come in air salt waves.
Yeah.
Well, if you're a mountain man, you're living up in the Rocky Mountains, what do you do for mosquitoes?
Yeah, I don't
know. I didn't know, so I had to look it up. Well, what they did was they used to take willow bark and boil it. No, birch.
Birch bark.
Take birch and boil it down to where the tannic acid, they would boil all the tannic acid out of it.
Mm-hmm.
They pull the bark out. And then they would mix, for themselves, they would mix it with mink oil. That's made to stick to your skin. So they would put that mink oil, tannic acid concoction on their face and their arms and their hands, which kept the mosquitoes off of them. And then just a tannic acid liquid they would put on their horses' faces to keep the mosquitoes away from their eyes.
Does it work well?
It works, yeah.
Did they learn that from the Native Americans that they were trapping with?
I think they probably picked it up from the Blackfoot at the time, because the Blackfoot were, well, you know, some of them were friendly, some of them weren't. you know, it just depended on where they were. Because it was a Blackfoot that killed Rennie. Rensfeld Doggett.
Ooh, good name.
Yeah, it's a good name.
I like that one.
And Moon Cromwell. I love that guy.
Bobby Jean, I have a question for you. Have you ever written a book?
I have not written a book. I have never even considered writing a book. I have to say that over these three years, however many, it's 158 shows and 158 books or so, you know?
Right.
That I think I would like to, but, you know, the first book that would be of interest to me would be a book that would actually be capturing some of the wonderful things that our author guests have dropped during the conversations in the show, a lot about their process and how to deal with writer's block, yes or no, and other kinds of wonderful pearls of wisdom. I think I really feel that there's enough there content that could be a really, really interesting book.
So now I'm gonna say to you what Jim would say to me at this point.
Write it.
Yeah. What's stopping you? It's time to start.
Yeah.
Oh, I've told her that.
Well,
before,
I'll so. Tell you, I was telling Jim yesterday that I've had, I would say for myself, a writer's block for the last several years. And it's a blogging block since I'm not a writer. But on our website, and I'm putting up new product on the website every day, writing descriptions. You know, I write intros for guests on the other radio show that I do and our concerts. And I kind of am writing sort of all the time. But I really haven't blogged. And I both of our websites have a blog area. And I would make little feeble attempts. And I felt like I don't really have anything interesting to say. I don't want to just be product-driven all the time. There's got to be other interesting things that people might like to read about that have to do with Western fashion, Western history, all of kind of what our business dovetails. But, you know, Russ, I would sit down and I just would be dry. I just had no ideas to speak of. And the other day, about a month ago or so, I photographed some Western carvings that we have, a cowboy and a cowgirl, that were gifts to me, us, my husband and me, back in 92 from my parents. Mm-hmm. And they were carved by a carver by the name of Johnny Rep down in Vicksburg. And I've had them for years. I love them. We've never named them. We have no backstory on them. They've never really spoken to me, but they've traveled with us. They were in our store for years. People always wanted to buy them. They sit in my dining room. And I happened to catch them sort of by mistake in the camera, and they began to talk to me. And they are now blogging. They have names right out of Jim's family tree. Of course, they're wooden, so thinking of things with trees is very fun. And he is Abraham Hatfield. That's an actual name from Jim's family tree. And she's Marietta Morse. And they are beginning to blog. And just by blogging under their aliases has enabled me to also blog, and right now I just write about the radio shows. But it's been a really interesting, it's like my writer's block is gone. Now I have so many things I want to write about. I can't capture all my ideas.
Wow.
Well, at least now you're a writer.
Now you can write a
book. Now I'm a writer.
Now you can write a book with their frame of mind.
Right.
And Jim's
family
history.
Well, it's very interesting because I felt like, oh, well, I need to have a backstory for them before I start to write. And then I thought, no, that's procrastination. You just want to get writing.
You
and,
just make it up as you go.
I take a lot of photographs of them with things, and I've really learned. Marietta is a party girl, and certain things that I put her with, she is absolutely happy to be with those things. When I put Abraham with the same items, he looks at me like, come on, really? What are you doing putting me with this Navajo folk art? I don't want to, you know, I don't look good with this. Put Marietta here, and I'll put Marietta there. And she's like, yeah, this is cool.
You know, Bobby Jean, I had no idea how deeply disturbed you were.
Well, when you moved to Albuquerque,
you know, in the first part of Indoline, I had to figure out a way why Caleb turned out the way Caleb turned out, and the only way I could do it was the way I did it, which was he killed his father with an axe handle.
Right, right. But he was abused.
He was abused, and he got justice that way.
But and he was also blamed for his sister's death.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
So, but he became the Caleb Stringfield that got into it with the guy in Stringbean in the saloon.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah,
right.
The ex-ranger that got him fired.
Yeah. But Caleb was a good guy.
Caleb was a good guy.
Which is amazing that he turned out that well considering what his
Considering what his background was, yes. He did turn out pretty good.
Yeah.
Bobby Jean, what do you got? So the blocking is doing good.
Well, I'm getting it started. So you and they each have their own Facebook page now. You can follow Abraham or Marietta, and when I blog on our website, as soon as the blog is done, of course it sits right on the website. But I also share it over onto Facebook, and I've also created Pinterest boards. And Jim, I see that you pinned a pin yesterday.
I did. I think it was Jonah Blue, wasn't it?
Yeah, and Pinterest is new to me. There are folks that have been doing Pinterest for years now, but it's kind of new for me, and I have created a Rendezvous with a Writer, Writer's Block Pinterest board, and it's connected to Out West Shop, so all of the Pinterest boards are connected to the big board for Out West Shop. But Marietta has a board, and Abraham have a board, and I'm really kind of creating, you know, like they are personalities. And so this has really been kind of a fun project. It means, Jerry, that I don't go to bed at all now.
Oh, my God.
Well, I will tell you, Bobby Jean, because this is called the Writer's Block, I will honestly say to you, as I sit here, I have never brought in a guy with a gun. Russ is looking at me like, what the hell does that mean? John Sanford, when he was on the show,
right.
That's what he said about writer's block. He says, when I get stuck,
right.
I bring in a guy with a gun.
Right, right, right.
I've never brought in a guy with a gun. Because they all have guns.
Well, and I think Tosca's comment last week about, and she was
really doing a journal entry.
Her comment was journal.
Right.
You know, and of course, because she writes in first person, journaling
right.
is a really easy thing for her. But her suggestion of just get in your character's frame of mind
right.
and just write.
Right.
And maybe some of that will come in the book, but maybe it won't.
Maybe.
And I think that was another, like, really, we hadn't heard that before.
Well, I told you last week the name of a book that you can write.
Remember when Margaret Brownlee talked about changing the name?
Yes.
Going back and changing the name of a character?
Yes.
When I was starting to get this idea about these two folks being my bloggers, they didn't have names. And Jim and I probably thought about names for about a month. And I thought, I can't start till I have a name. And I would have a name, and I would kind of begin to think of a story or a blog. And then it'd be like, nope, that's not her name. And it wasn't until we sat with his sister, with his family's family tree, handwritten on documents that had been in his family for a long time. Abraham Hatfield from 1804, that's where the name comes from. And those two names just jumped. They just jumped off those pages. I'm like, that's their name. And they both characters, I had them with me because I photographed them in a cornfield when we were at his sister's. And they were both like, yep, that's it.
Bobby,
that's
you're killing name. Us.
And
you're killing us. Have you looked at the time?
Look,
you know what time it is?
Look over your shoulder.
I'm over.
Say goodbye,
God,
Bobby.
Go.
Look over your shoulder and see if there's a drone
We'll talk to you next week, Bobby Jean.
All right. It's great talking to y'all tonight.
It's been fun,
right,
Bobby.
Bye.
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 Wow.
Oh.
All right. We ran over, so I'm sorry. But anyway, that's our Thursday night show.
I do want to say, though, thank you very much for making me do this book.
Oh, well, because now you've got to read Jonah Blue.
Yeah, so that'll be my next one, which we were supposed to talk about tonight.
Oh, my God, Jonah Blue is like it's a totally different story.
Okay.
It's a totally different story. It's really good. In fact, it goes up into the country that you love up in Montana.
I will have it read for our next show so we can chat a few minutes about it.
Perfect. Okay, well, that's it for us tonight. We have managed to shoot another Thursday Night in the Ass. And, of course, this is LA Talk Radio. This is The Writer's Block. I am Jim Christina in studio with Russ Avison. And, of course, the bookie is sitting here. And for us, and thank you so much for sticking with us and listening to the show. And we'll be back with you next week. And as far as that goes, we are out of here.